Johnny O'Connor bought an automobile. He took his sweetheart for a ride one Sunday. Johnny was togged up in his best Sunday clothes. She nestled close to his side. Things went just dandy till he got down the road. Then something happened to the old machinery. That engine got his goat, off went his hat and coat. Everything needed repairs. He'd have to get under, get out and get under, to fix his little machine. He was just dying to cuddle his queen. But every minute, when he'd begin it, he'd have to get under, get out and get under. Then he'd get back at the wheel. A dozen times they'd start to hug and kiss, and then the darned old engine, it would miss. And then he'd have to get under, get out and get under, and fix up his automobile. Millionaire Wilson said to Johnny one day, your little sweetheart don't appreciate you. I have a daughter who is hungry for love. She likes to ride every day. Johnny had visions of a million in gold. He took her riding in his little auto. But every time that he went to say, marry me, 'twas the old story again. He'd have to get under, get out and get under, to fix his little machine. He was just dying to cuddle his queen. But every minute, when he'd begin it, he'd have to get under, get out and get under. Then he'd get back at the wheel. Every time that he would reach for a kiss, it seems a darned old spark plug, it would miss. And then he'd have to get under, get out and get under, and fix up his automobile. He'd have to get under, get out and get under, to fix his little machine. He was just dying to cuddle his queen. But every minute, when he'd begin it, he'd have to get under, get out and get under. Then he'd get back at the wheel. It seems that once she sat down on his knee, and then he lost control, ran right up a tree. And then he had to get under, get out and get under, and fix up his automobile.
Good evening. Bernie Golias here. A little froggy voice with it. But I am here, and another week went by. And I know that this week, I'm glad that it went by so quickly, because I know everybody can't wait for the show. So we're back here now, so I hope you're enjoying this evening and recording, if you want to record it. And we got, actually, tonight, two guests that we're having on, which is a very unique situation here, and we'll get into that, and we'll introduce you to those guests here shortly. But I'm Bernie Golias, your host, and this show is called The Auto Era. And what do we do that's fantastic? Well, we talk about the history of Cleveland, the automobile industry, and what makes this area of town so unique. Yeah, we had over 80 cars built in the city of Cleveland alone at the turn of the last century. We had over 115 cars and automobiles and vehicles made in northern Ohio, or actually northeast Ohio, and over 540 automobiles built in Ohio alone. So we are a hotbed of the industry. And in the past, we had some very, very special guests. And, of course, all guests are very special because they know what they're talking about. And you can also, if you know what you're talking about, and even if you don't know what you're talking about, you're more than welcome to call in and talk. And the phone number to call is 440-775-8139. Well, actually, this is the second last show of the season. Next week, we'll be finishing up. And then we'll be at a long break because of the summer, and but I'll get into that a little bit more. Well, you know, we had some excellent conversations over the last 6 months or more, And tonight's show is going to be quite, like I say, unique. And I'm going to get the introduce you to our guest. First of all, Dave Buehler, who has been on the show before. He talked about Templar. And we have Mike Logie on. He's this evening as well. And he is going to be talking about Cleveland history. And we'll have some really fantastic conversations here. So first of all, let me introduce Dave Buehler. Welcome to the show, Dave.
Good evening, Bernie.
And Mike, welcome to the show.
Good evening, Bernie.
Okay, we all are clicking. Ain't that special? Well, anyway, gentlemen, you really know a lot of history here in the town. And Dave, you have a phenomenal collection of Templar automobiles. Maybe you can give our audience a little bit of a rundown on yourself. And then, Mike, you can take it second here and give a little rundown on yourself and some of the areas of expertise that you're going to share with the audience this evening.
Thanks, Bernie. Well, I guess I would describe myself as a self-made failure, and many times over, and that's part of life. And I've been lucky enough to, live in Lakewood and discover the Templar Motors company story, and we're trying to bring it to the consciousness of the local community. And I've been lucky enough to acquire a few cars and put them back in the original factory. And Mike has been a longtime friend and supporter of it, so it's great to join him tonight. And Mike, what do you think about being on radio?
Well, it's my first time. In 63 years.
I mean, how good.
But my interest is basically history. Old buildings that I would go past on my way to work. And many times there would be other, newer companies in those old buildings. And I'd always wonder, what the heck were they before?
Why don't you tell us about the one big building that you worked in, where you made lampshades?
W.S. Tyler Company, which was located at 36 and Superior, who was a maker of wire mesh. They were around in the 1860s, 1870s, right around the time that the elevator was invented. So what did they enclose elevators with? Wire mesh. So they made wire screening that went into elevator cars. Ultimately, they wound up doing the cast metalwork that went into buildings like the Chrysler Building in New York.
And where's the Tyler Building located?
East 36 and Superior. Basically, it goes it runs from 34th Street to 38th Street, and covers about 1.5 million square feet of space. And that is the type of place that I've always been interested in. And as you know, there are buildings all over town, from Elyria all the way to Willoughby. There were early cars built in Elyria. The Studebaker Garford, which I think was built sometime around 1910.
Correct.
Arthur Garford was basically the industrial engine of Elyria and Lorain County. He built bicycles. He made lace. He did probably 10 to the present-day Invacare Company. Basically, was its lineage goes back to Arthur Garford. Prior to Invacare, it was Colson Castor, which you might have heard of.
Sure.
And
Well, one of the things that's always been very interesting in the history here in Cleveland is, 100 years ago, let's just say use 100 years ago, you look at all this industry that was here, and it was seemingly endless at the time, and how fast it grew, and all the various, manufacturers, et cetera, that almost tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people that they employed. You kind of wonder where they all gone. But a lot of these remnants still exist, and this is what Mike is really good at. And of course, with the history of what we're doing here with the automobile, and there's a lot of great historians that write this stuff down, because if it's not written down, it's not history. And as fast as everything's going nowadays, they're tearing these buildings down. They're just simply parking lots, not even anymore. They just tear them down because they are, some of them are decrepit, but there's a lot of really nice buildings around. And Mike, is there anything that really is stands out for your interest? I mean, is you, I don't want to cut you short on the history because you're doing a great job on it. But I'm just going off track here a little bit. What if the audience wanted to really see something that really existed? Really, you know, that elevator building, the Tyler Building, is really phenomenal too. That's a beautiful architecture there.
Right.
And is there any other historic landmarks still around that you can recommend for people to go out and take a look at? Because this is what this is all about, you know, a little education here.
Here again, in Lakewood, the Templar Building, which is in the Birdtown area of Lakewood. There were two schools of thought in that area, building a building such as what Templar evolved to be, about a 60-foot-wide building that allowed light in.
Yeah.
From windows, because there was very little electric lighting available at the time, or single floor buildings with sawtooth roofs. And eventually the single floor building without sawtooth roofs won out after the invention of the fluorescent bulb, which was about 1938. But that is a terrific example.
Yeah, hunk and conky construction all over town.
Yes.
He has this, you know, design, and it's all about 60 foot wide.
Yeah.
It's twisted rebar construction. And, mm-hmm. you know, the Cleveland, back in the turn of the century, 1900 to like 1920, they were described as the fifth in the sixth city. Mm-hmm. It's the fifth largest city in the United States at that
right.
time.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a dramatic city of commerce. We were really one of the largest producers of munitions for the First World War in Cleveland, from all over the community. So it's an interesting to see the Industrial Revolution come through Cleveland and still leave the landmarks where they are.
Yeah, well, we hope some of them stay. And they can be reused. A good example of that was the Ford building at 11610 Euclid Avenue, which has basically now become the main building for the Cleveland Institute of Art.
Yeah.
They incorporated a new building to its west, and it's gorgeous. We were just in there last week. It's because the building is basically, as Dave was saying, it's poured on-site concrete. It's basically indestructible. And you could replace windows, you could replace anything you want on the building, and it's going to stand.
Yeah, they're bunkers. They're bunkers.
Right, and in that Ford building, I know we have a show coming up in June, the AACA Northern Chapter and Crawford Western Reserve Historical Society, putting on a Cleveland-based all-star show for cars made in Cleveland and Northern Ohio. But that building there that you were mentioning, in regards to the Ford, they were building them up, I believe, up in, well, even there, 1915. Some of those cars, there may be one or two that are going to be coming to that show. They just need to prove their provenance that they were built there. But even Model A's were built in Cleveland. And, of course, I know you guys probably want to talk about Ohio Blower and all the bodies being right. built there. And I know Dave's an expert at Roubaix bodies right down the street. And we'll kick a little bit about Winton in. But, there's still a lot of good stuff there. And thank goodness they're renovating some of these buildings. And, in fact, the Cleveland Chandler Building was just purchased, I believe, on East 154th or 155th.
Yeah, London Road.
And they renovated that. And isn't that a Cleveland clinic that bought that or something? I think it's a private individual now. Yeah, Cleveland Clinic was going to buy it, but I think another private individual bought it.
Cleveland Clinic had owned it for about 10 years.
That's right, yeah.
After Parker Hannifin had moved out.
Okay. Yeah, well, at least they're renovating some of them. A lot of them else are being torn down. And, of course, if you look at the Packard facility in Detroit, I think that's, 6 million square feet being torn down now? They tried to renovate it.
Oh, they are tearing it down.
Yeah, someone tried. There was a few different buyers, and I may stand corrected, but I believe they finally realized that it's just beyond repair, and I think they are starting to tear it down now.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Oh, when you abandon a building for 50 years, it takes its toll.
Right. It'll live another 50 years. You won't even know it's there, except remnants. It'll be like digging up an archives or something. But
Mike, what do you think about the Baker Building renovation down on Euclid Avenue?
Well, there again, that is a, I forget the architect, but it's a gorgeous building. A lot of windows. Makes it's suitable for use for a lot of different offices. Are they doing any residential in there, or is it strictly office?
I'm not sure. You know, they had on the second level, there was chauffeur rooms, so the guys would stay overnight, and they would get calls, you know, for during the night. The only thing that I know they're non-commercial is I think St. Peter's is worshiping there still, so
really?
It's a great place, yeah.
That's right. That basically was being used as a charging station for Baker Electrics, too, wasn't
it? Yes, it was.
Huh. Well, speaking of Baker Electrics and charging stations, isn't there still a residence in Lakewood that was set up for the Baker Electric to be recharged?
Well, Walter Baker lived at the corner of Lake Road and West Clifton Boulevard. His house is still there. Luckily, it's been owned by people who have an appreciation for it. They've taken very good care of it. One of the unique things, and I could never figure out, there is a turntable in the garage, tool, manually operated, to allow you to park your car, and by pushing the car in a half circle, you could turn the car around. And the Baker Electric would have had a reverse gear. It would just have to reverse the DC motor. That's one thing I could never.
Well, you know, it's illegal to back out into the street. And most people don't know that, but
it is illegal.
It is illegal to do that, and everybody does it.
Huh.
That everywhere, Dave?
Yeah. Well, it was in Cleveland Heights. It was in
How
Lakewood.
How did you find that out?
I got a ticket.
Oh,
that's Lakewood.
But anyway, the rumor was always they didn't have reverse, and that's baloney. They had reverse.
All they had to do was
I think it was just easier.
Okay.
Yeah. And Mrs. Baker lived there in that house, too, so maybe it was made as a convenience. But it's a unique feature, isn't it?
And one thing I do know is that Walter Baker's last car was a Buick.
Wow, that's amazing.
What year was that?
Probably late 1940s. I think he was around till then. But
even Alexander Winton, I believe, enjoyed. It was Cadillac, I believe, because he liked those multi cylinder vehicles, and I believe he had a V12 Cadillac or something like that. But they got into that stuff because of the engineering aspects of it. They were all kind of neat.
Mr. Baker did a lot of things. And American Ball Bearing developed that, Standard Products. He married one of the white girls, as in the White Motors family's daughter. And also, he had a friend named Sloan, and they started testing the gyroscope out in Lake Erie on a boat.
Right.
Yeah, Baker and Sloan first started, and this is like turn-of-the-century stuff.
It's not Alfred Sloan, is it?
Yeah.
No, Alfred Sloan.
Yeah.
From GM?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. And so, anyway, a little Baker fact. I'm a fan of Walter.
That's why they call it educational radio.
Yes.
Absolutely. And speaking of which, I'll give a station ID here. This is the Auto Air you're listening to. I'm Bernie Golias, your host, and you're listening also to our guests, Dave Buehler and Mike Logie, and we are talking about Cleveland history and, of course, a lot of automotive history here in Cleveland. And this is WOBC 91.5 FM, Oberlin College and Community Radio. And we're having a good time here talking about the history of some of the automotive magnates and the industrial times here in Cleveland with automotive-related issues. But I have a question for, I know Dave is a Templar expert, and they also made Templar bodies but speaking of, we were talking about Roubaix and Templar and a few other things here, but the Roubaix body was just down the street from Winton. Everybody in the audience needs to know here, and speaking of which, if you want to call in, the phone number is 440-775-8139. Be patient. We try to get you on here. But Everything you think within a 1 or 2 mile radius, and you think of the west side of Cleveland, and we realize, I mentioned earlier, 80 specific makes of vehicles were made within the city limits of Cleveland. And of course, the city limits of Cleveland, 100 and some years ago, really only consisted of probably just a few miles. So that's a lot of cars being made in that area. But what exists here, and when you're looking at Berea Road, that's Winton, the motor company there, and then, of course, just down the street you had Baker Electric and Roubaix Body, and then just down the street the other way you had Templer, and you had Parrish and Bingham Frame right across the street from Winton. You had Glidden Paint just on the same corner, basically, as where Winton was. All these major manufacturers that were in business at the time, buying from each other to build these automobiles. A lot of them already have perished, the buildings. But, Dave, give us a little bit of insight on Roubaix, because I know there's Ohio Blower was just down the street. That was another one. They made bodies for Model A's, Model T's, Duesenbergs, Moons, you name it. So I know you would like to talk about that. So give our audience a little bit of insight on that.
Sure, I'll be glad to. Leon Roubaix was a Frenchman brought into the United States by the White Motor Company to build custom bodies. And if you look at the land charts, down by West 78th and 76th, the White brothers owned most of that property with Walter Baker. And so they brought him over from France. He actually started out selling Magnetos in New York and LaCosta Magnetos. But anyway, he came and started to build, for many people, Marmon bodies, Duesenberg A's, Packards, very unique bodies, not only for Templer, but for anybody that wanted a custom body. The thing about that whole neighborhood is it's all integrated on the railroad, and it speaks volumes of how it was all planned. The Industrial Revolution brought to the Near West Side, they're all on the for transportation and for goods, and it's very interesting to see how it was set up, very well engineered and designed. Leon Roubaix was one of the coach builders, famous coach builders in Cleveland. There were a couple of them just in that neighborhood. The Ohio Blower was on 91st in Detroit, and then you go up to Lang Body, which was at West 106th and Western, from Roush and Lang, which was on 25th Street. But if you start looking at the automotive manufacturers just on the Near West Side there, you can start counting them. I mean, there's Roubaix, Baker, Owens Magnetic, Templer, Winton, Marsh, Kurtz, and they're all on the same railroad tracks. So it's kind of interesting. Mike, you've been down to West 78th to the studios. What do you think about that building?
The reuse that they've used, the uses they use that building for are good interim use before, let's say, it gets redeveloped into housing or something.
Right.
Like
that whole Lakeshore area is very hot right now.
Now, whose building is the one that's being redone now into condominiums immediately west of Roubaix's building? I think it's going to be encompassed within the Battery Park
program. Yeah, I don't know who the owners are, but yeah, I've seen that from the Shoreway.
I think it was an automotive-related company called Globe Stamping. Had you ever heard of them?
Yes, I have.
Okay, what do you know about them?
Very little.
Oh, okay. Well, anyway.
But I've heard of them.
Their building is going through a significant, it's a good reuse.
Yeah.
Speaking of reuse, we had a question come in. Mm-hmm. And the question was from Joe in North Olmsted. He wanted to know if there's any, let's say, lineage of manufacturers, let's say like Baker Electric. I know White would probably be one, but any of these buildings, anybody still in any of the buildings under a different name, making other things that may have started out in the automobile industry?
Not that I know of.
You know, I can think of White, you know, White Motors, because you have, I believe, Viking,
Viking bought the sewing machine division.
Yeah, sewing machine division, and then I believe Volvo trucks still has a lineage with White, but I don't believe anything is being made in the buildings. At least personally, I don't. I mean, yeah. In the same buildings, but even under different names. And that's the only thing, because even with Winton, when Winton Engine was around, then they changed their name to Cleveland Diesel when GM bought them in 1930. Then they were basically stayed around to 50s. And then they changed it to a couple other diesel names, and Detroit Diesel Allison, I think, but still is around. But it's nothing is in the same area or in the building anymore. Guide Lighting was the same one, but that they don't do anything in Cleveland anymore.
Right.
Of course, with the TRW history, there's nothing here anymore with that. You know, they started making valves, actually, for Winton in 1903. I don't think so. So, Joe, that was a good question.
Probably Eaton.
Eaton might be, yeah.
Yeah. I would think probably Eaton's probably the big last survivor from lineage of supplying axles for probably more than 80 years.
No, I don't know where they make axles now. Do they still make axles?
Good question. I know they make valves in Cleveland, but...
where do they make valves?
Over on the east side.
Are they around 82nd, somewhere on the south side?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, okay. And, Baker basically morphed into a material handling
forklift, right?
You're right.
Correct.
You will still see Baker forklifts.
Yeah.
Although I think they now use a different name. They were bought by a German company and use the name of that company. In fact, they, after they left the Lake Avenue and 89th Street area, they went to Tiedemann Road. They moved into the old Lampson and Sessions factory, which that complex is now being used by Key Bank as their processing center.
Okay. Very nice.
Well, gentlemen, we're going to take a little a break here now, so we're going to do a PSA. But you're listening to The Auto Era, and this is Bernie Goliath, your host. And this is WOBC Oberlin 91.5 FM, Oberlin College and Community Radio.
Ah, there's that horn now. You know I'm wild about horn. On automobiles that go ta 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 ta. I don't know what there is about horn. But you can't get a girl without one. I ain't had a girlfriend for many a night. Since I got that new girl, I'm doing all right. I'm wild about horns on automobiles that go ta 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 ta. Thank you.
How about that? Bernie Goliath here again, your host for the Auto Era. This is WOBC. Oberlin 91.5 FM, Oberlin College and Community Radio. And I still got a little frog in my voice here, but that's okay. We're making it, and that's what makes history in itself. And we got two great guests here. But I wanted to answer a couple of questions that we were discussing earlier on a couple topics. And I just wanted to give a little bit of insight to this. First of all, regarding the Ford plant here in Cleveland, that branch assembly was here starting making Ford Model Ts, assembling them from parts brought from by rail from Ford stamping plants, mostly from Detroit, obviously, and they were manufactured here until 1932. So Fords were assembled in that plant by where the art facility is now on Euclid. That was being done until 1932. And also, another interesting area is the Gabriel shock, I should say, and the Gabriel horn and hydraulic shock absorbers were also manufactured here in Cleveland. And the other question was about valves, and I mentioned Winton was buying them from Charles Thompson, and he began making valves for Winton engines in 1904. So that company became Thompson Products in 1926. And then later, TRW. And the Torbenson Gear and Axle Company moved to Cleveland in 1915, and that evolved into Eaton Corporation. So that's where they made a lot of different axles for everybody. And Willard storage batteries were also made here in Cleveland from 1896 on until about 1908. So, the Case School of Applied Science graduates also founded Lubrisol Corporation in 1928, and they made motor additives and marketed a variety of different types of oils and lubrications for automobiles. So, you can give that some thought, too. And then even when we look into something more even contemporary, well, this is just some statistics. 70% of all the steel made in Cleveland was designed and developed and made for the automotive industry by 1920s. So that's a lot of steel just being made for cars, but they started eventually making, you know, steel into buildings and everything else. But a lot of the other aspects, too, here, some of the main body plants, Fisher Body, I'm sure everybody is aware of the Fisher Body plant on Coit Road, that opened in 1922 to make car bodies for General Motors. And I can tell you some stories about that because I remember some of the people that used to work there. But that's another story. And just another little fact. even though Akron was considered the concentration of the rubber industry in the tire industry in the world, there were over 40 rubber factories in the city of Cleveland area alone. So when you think of that, that was quite an interesting phenomenon as well. So we go back to our guests, Dave Buehler and Mike Logie, and they know what they're talking about. So I'm going to go back to those guys, and we were talking about a lot of different things, so I'm just going to let them continue in their quest for total and absolute perfection.
Well, Mike had some interesting observations about the Jordan Motor Car Company and what they brought to the auto industry and changed the auto industry. And Mike, why don't you give us some of your thoughts on that? It's an interesting part of Cleveland's history.
Well, there were Advertising Age magazine sometime around after the turn of this century did a list of the 100 most memorable advertising slogans of the 20th century. And two of them were related to Cleveland-based automotive manufacturers. One of them was the line, somewhere west of Laramie. You can Google that, somewhere west of Laramie. Up until 1920 or so, till this ad for Jordan came out. And a magazine ad for a car basically would give the specifications of the car, the length, the horsepower, wheelbase. But somewhere west of Laramie, basically started selling an ideal. It basically was a dream. It's selling a dream. You buy this car, you're going to wind up somewhere west of Laramie with it, with beautiful people surrounding you. And that changed the idea of advertising in the United States. That line, Google it, somewhere west of Laramie. The other one, of course.
Well, Mike, can I interject? It didn't hurt them that they named a car the Playboy as well.
Right. Yeah, that was one of the cars they were advertising was the Playboy. Although at that time, Playboy, I think, goes back to F. Scott Fitzgerald. I think he was the original.
They also had Tomboy as well, so they covered all bases.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
No, the other line that was one of the most memorable was Hey Mabel Black Label, which was from a company that sprung from Peerless Motor Car. After Prohibition was repealed in 1932, they saw the writing on the wall, left the car business, and went into the beer business and started brewing Carling Black Label. So it's kind of loosely related
to drinking. Yeah, they don't drink and drive anymore, though. You know that.
Right. Well, that's true. But they did for about 40 years after that, after they coined that term.
Things have changed, huh?
Oh, definitely. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Well, that's very interesting. And I think part of the evolution of our Cleveland history and some of this stuff that we're able to put our hands around and drive around town and kind of look at the building and say, hey, you know, I guess that makes sense. And so there was a couple things that I guess I wanted to make observations about just in the sense of Cleveland history and the Public Auditorium building as well as the Masonic Temple building on 36th being built in 1920 and having a big celebration open up with 10,000 Templar Knights walking down Euclid Avenue to open up the place on October 13th, 1920. So, this whole thing is tied into De Molay being burned at the stake. And that's why we have Friday the 13th, because De Molay got burned at the stake on Friday, October 13th. And so they had the celebration and opening of the Masonic Auditorium on 36th and Euclid.
And what year was that, Dave?
1920.
What? Who got burned at the stake in 1920?
No, De Molay got burned at the stake like in the
1100s. Preceded that by a few years. Now, is there a connection between Templar, the car, and Mesa, the Masonic culture?
Well, thanks for the great lead-in. You must know me. Yes, absolutely. The management team were all Masons and, in fact, Templar Knights, and hence the name Templar. And if you look at all the appointments on the cars, they have all the Mortise cross on the accelerator plate, on the hubcaps, on the motor meter. And this is all about the 8 points of the cross and the 8 Beatitudes, to live like the virtues of the 8 Beatitudes if you're a Templar Knight. And now, they didn't really do that, but they tried. They pledged themselves to that, but I don't think that was really their main direction.
And give us a little insight on the gentleman with Templar that helped do the paving for the Superior Bridge, I believe
it was. Matthew Frederick Bramley, probably one of the biggest characters in the city of Cleveland that nobody knows. Mm-hmm. And he owned Trinidad Paving, the largest paving company in the world at one point, and he also owned Luna Park, and he was also president of Templar Motors. So he was a pretty big deal internationally as well. He actually bought Admiral Perry's associate, McMillan, and when he went to the Antarctic, had a boat named the Perry, and Bramley ends up buying this boat. It's a ship, 150-foot yacht, and takes 40 of his closest friends at the height of the Depression in 1929 on a boat for 14 months, and they go through the Panama Canal and go out to California and back. But anyway, I digress. But anyway, so thanks for the lead-in about the Masons. Yes, Templar Motors is totally about the Masons.
Now, what ultimately happened to Matthew Bramley? I know he owned Cleveland Trinidad Paving for many years. And he was also in the moving and storage business, too, wasn't he? But he had to be in other things, I would think.
Yeah, he actually owned Bass Lake. He owned 8,000 acres out there where he raised, close to 2,000 steer. He brought the Bramley apple from England. It's they planted them out in Independence out by old Coliseum.
Really?
Yeah, I've been told that there's still Bramley apple trees out there.
Is that Bob's apples?
I don't know.
Well, you know, when you go out, when you Route 21 and Route 21 and 77, that was all farmlands. I remember there was a major apple orchard there, and it was called, I believe, Bob's Apples. But I don't know what it was prior to that, but that goes back. I mean, they closed that place down probably 30 years ago. But there's still a lot of apple trees along that that road there, and I believe that is could be State Road in the Route 21 area right there in the corner going on to Route 77 in Richfield. So that's interesting. More history. You find out about it here in the auto era. And we got 10, 15 minutes left here. But you're listening to the auto era, and that's Dave Buehler is a guest, and Mike Logie is a guest. And, I'm your host. And this is WOBC Oberlin 91.5 FM, Oberlin College, and Community Radio. And we're going to keep going on this because there's never enough time when you're having so much fun. So, where... Dave, you have a collection of Templars, and what do you think, what is your favorite, I know it's hard to say which one is your favorite kids, you know, but I mean, yeah, I'm sure you have something that's favorite and it's unique, and I know you have a Roubaix-bodied Templar, so maybe give us a little insight on that. We can go off to maybe Ohio Blower a little bit on that and talk about some of the things that are just right in our area, neck of the woods.
Sure. Well, I guess I'm blessed to have a couple very unique cars. Just dumb luck. Didn't know what you're looking at and buying and all that good stuff. But I have a sedan, a Templar sedan that has 375 miles on it. And it's very unique. It's got a Roubaix body, and it's just a real treasure. Talk about patina. And so that's probably one of my favorite. It's been just such a thrill to do this. This was not a planned event for me. Mike actually has known me for a fairly long time and really knew me at the infancy of all this, which goes back, 10, 15 years ago, easy. And so there was a time that Dave didn't talk much about Templars, and his wife, Grace, was happy about that, and everybody was good, but we've all adjusted.
It wasn't that long ago that Dave never heard of Templars.
Truly.
He just started his collection in, 1995?
That's right. And I grew up in Lakewood, didn't know anything about it.
Right. It was built within a mile of where he lived, where he grew up.
And, that's one of the things that when I bring people on the show here and people call in, that's the whole purpose of this. The more people that get used to the show and they start realizing that so-and-so may have worked at a certain plant, they start researching their family roots of where their father or grandfather or uncle worked. Before you know it, there's people that say, oh, my grandfather worked at Winton, or he worked at Parrish and Bingham, or he worked at the Guide Lighting or Standard Products. There's so many things that are right in our own backyard that people are not aware of, and that's one of the reasons why I wanted to start this show, was to get engaged, have the community become engaged in these conversations, call in, and ask questions. And that's why it's an educational format here. And you're absolutely right. There's so many things that are right in our own backyard that you don't know what's there unless you really do research on it. And that's what's really interesting. Speaking, people that really can know a little bit more about what's going on in the city are a lot of construction workers, because they're always digging up sewers, and they're looking for things, and before you know it, they find all these tunnels and things that are not even on maps anymore. So it's really interesting. We got another phone call, so you guys keep talking.
Yeah. Well, Dave, if it wasn't for you, the Templar would have been as obscure as the Ben-Hur, which was built in Willoughby. It's, nobody knows who owned the company. Nobody knows if there are any of the cars existing. Dave Buehler, from 1995 on, made it a point to go out and seek not only cars, but anything remotely related to the company. And thanks to places like eBay, you've been able to
absolutely
do that.
Couldn't have done it without Google and eBay. It's crazy. I mean, I bought a car from Australia on eBay. Sorry to admit that to everybody, but I've gone to the dark side. And
why is it the dark side?
Well, I mean, you buy something. It's the old-fashioned way when you bought a car was you went out and you visited the guy. You looked at it. You touched it. You know, you got underneath it and all that good stuff. This, you know, article of faith, and it's an interesting transition. I think one of the things for me about this whole project for the Templar Motor Factory Display has been these people that come up and say, hey, my great uncle worked here. And it just happened to me. We open up for the artist studios about four times a year. And this gentleman came up and had two pictures of his great uncle on the proving track at Templar Motors and let me copy these. It was just fabulous. I mean, it's really about the people. I had another interesting interaction with Dolores Holliday. Reach out to Dolores. I need to call you. If you're listening, hello.
Where does she live?
She lives in West Park, and she is the daughter of Arthur Holliday, who drove with Cannonball Baker in the Templar across the country. She lives in the same house. And as she grew up, she never left, she never married, and she has pictures of her father and Cannonball Baker on the walls. And she was kind enough to, you know, let me copy these. And this is what it's all about, in the sense of meeting people, and it's their lives. And so it's a really fascinating aspect of this whole thing.
Well, we had another call come in by Charlie and Lorraine, and he wanted to know the Standard Building. He thought, he said he worked there. In that building at one time, and someone said it was Winton that was in there, but I know it wasn't, unless they were doing something. But do any of you know what was in the Standard Building?
You mean Standard Products?
Standard Products, yes.
That, I believe, was Guide Lighting.
Yeah, there's...
And that's right down on 110th and...
right.
Between Berea Road and Western, right?
Right.
In that area, 117th area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, actually, Standard Products was the company that almost put Templar Motors out of business.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they were talk about not diversified vendors. They locked in to both their differentials and their front axles with Standard Products. And so orders started to rise, and they couldn't deliver. So they got into a lawsuit with them and found out Standard Products was almost broke. And so they had to sue them for the dies, and then Templar goes forward and buys into U.S. Axle in Pottstown, Pennsylvania, to get their, you know, differentials and front axles from that on. So it's, another part of the Cleveland history is very interesting.
Yeah, that's true. And so, okay, so to answer the gentleman that called in, the Standard Products was, now, the time frame here. Standard Products, Guide Lighting. It was in the same building.
Well, let me tell you.
Or near it.
I think Guide preceded.
Yeah, because then Guide.
Guide was up on West 114th.
Okay, and then Guide left, obviously, to go to Detroit.
And then another interesting fact about Standard Products was the first 10 Templars were made at Standard Products.
Really?
They didn't have a building.
Dark.
Yeah.
Oh.
They didn't have a building or anything, and they wanted to get going, so they were doing a parallel path of building the factory, but they had an engine ready to go in June, and they had no building until December. So they built the first 10, and that's what I was telling you about the first Templar over to the Detroit Superior Bridge was in November, because that's when they first got the 10 done. Mm-hmm. And the thing about Templar being first over the bridge was because Hunk and Conkey built the bridge, and then Bramley paved it, and these guys were vice president and president of Templar Motors, so there was no way that no other car was going to go across that bridge. It was in the Plain Dealer in November of 1917. Got a copy of it.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
And it's amazing that all these companies that we're talking about here, again, are within just a block of each other.
Okay, I got another one. Okay, Stinchcomb. You know, Stinchcomb Memorial in the Metro Parks.
Right.
Okay, we say the Valley, nobody knows what we're talking about, but the Metro Parks. Well, Stinchcomb was the county engineer, and he received a Templar for some reason, mysterious reason, and his son, Tom, rode with him over in the Templar. Okay, Tom, fast forward, ends up being the mayor of Berea in the 60s, and he owned a Templar, and I ended up buying it from him. Okay? So, I mean, and he was the first, he was in the Templar across the bridge, Detroit Superior Bridge. And so the first car, Templar, through the valley because Mr. Stinchcomb owned it.
Amazing.
Yeah.
And it's good to bring these cars back, you know, and that's, you know, that's one of the things we're doing in June. Yeah, for people that want to come out to see these, some of these cars, we got Peerlesses, Wintons. Hopefully, we'll have a Templar. You know, and the Baker. So we're going to have a lot of these cars at this show at the Ursuline College on June 13th. So write that down and see if you can make it for that, because that's going to be a very nice event. And if you need to, also, I think we're going to have a little gathering at the building. The Dave Buehler is going to be hosting on Friday night, June 12th.
Actually, Mike's helping serve, too.
And Mike's going to be, oh, that's great, that's great. So, you know, it's going to be good. And that way you can see some of these cars. So,
so Bernie, we got about 5 minutes, and Mike has got one big story he's got to get in before the end of the show.
Okay, you got, show. Actually, yeah, you got 5 minutes, exactly.
You blew me in. Which story?
Well, you're good at this.
Go for it.
Okay. Go ahead, Mike. Tell us about what do you think about any of the train history and the car barns and all that kind of stuff?
Well, that I don't know that much about.
Yep.
But I, let's say you're talking about the streetcar era. There was a company in Collinwood called Kullman Carr who built probably most of the streetcars used in Cleveland and in various other cities. Their building still exists with the Kullman Car Company name still on it, except the K is missing, south of I-90 on East 140th Street. Anytime any of you are in the neighborhood and see it, you'll know what it is. And bus bodies were another thing that were built in the area. There was a company called Bender Body. Mm-hmm. It started out somewhere in the area of about 69th and Denison. Does that sound right? But then they moved to Elyria, I believe, 1930. So they were a Lorain County company probably for at least 10 years before their demise.
Was Fruhoff involved with that at all?
I don't think so. Fruhoff, you know, there again, that was another company. Fruhoff was an Indiana company. And opened up that big plant near the lake in Avon. Avon, where was it? Was that Lorain or was that Avon?
I think it was Lorain because Ford did Ford took over some of that building.
Right. And then Fruhoff evaporated. One year they were gone.
Yeah. It's amazing.
Yeah. And that happened. Well, as we know, that happens with a lot of companies for various reasons. But and what other, let's see, yeah, Bender Body, I think most of the buses that you will see now in the Grand Canyon,
okay,
they run the old 1930s buses, I believe, I'm not sure, but most of those may be Bender Body buses.
I have a photo album of Lang Body Company. Mm-hmm. And they have one particular picture of a bus. It's got a body on it. It's a white bus, but it's got a Lang body on it, and it's pictured right at West Boulevard there at the Cadell Center with the clock tower. Mm. And it's definitely a white bus, and Lang had a body on it.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Now, another body maker for buses in the area was called Brown.
Okay.
And they, I think, were located in the area of 40th and Payne, like at the northeast corner, or somewhere close to that. And another out-of-town body company who made car bodies was Briggs Manufacturing, who was, you know, later they would do things like in the area around World War II. They built bodies for Packard and things like that. They were in that area with Willard Storage Battery in the East 131st Street area. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, they got out of the body business and went into making plumbing fixtures.
Sure. Well, that sounds very good. Now, one thing that I want to try to get covered today, Bernie was going to allow me, was the so what of Templar Motors. We had been kind enough to let me talk a little bit about that, but we really want to talk about for a minute about a gentleman by the name of Irwin George Baker, alias Cannonball Baker. And Templar Motor hired Cannonball in 1920 to drive a Templar across the country. And very unique one man, one car type of setting. He did set the record. Everybody knows this by the Burt Reynolds movie, The Cannonball Run. As soon as I say that, everybody dials in. Oh, yeah, we remember that. But actually, one of the aspects of Templar Motors was Cannonball. So it's a very interesting one. And we just recently have found a little news clip of from 1920 of him driving the Templar. So it should be very interesting. We're try to have that on display.